Houston and Atlanta, so I wouldn't have relied on it throughout the season. I would rather have been told that 2001 would be a make-or-break year, that we needed to advance deep into the playoffs and maybe win the Super Bowl if I wanted to keep my job. In that case, I would have stuck with Les rather than hiring Clyde and overhauling the offense, since I was thinking long-term. At the same time, however, I have never lost sight of the fact that the Glazers saw me as an NFL head coach when no one else did. They gave me my first opportunity, and I'll always be grateful to them for that. So no, there was no one to be upset with. God just wanted me to move on to a different situation. His time for me in Tampa had been completed. Chapter 15, A Soft Landing. I held a press conference the following day in Tampa. People might have expected me to be angry with the Glazers. I disagreed with their decision, but I truly believed that since they owned the Buccaneers, it was their decision to make. Plus, if I trust God that all things work together for good, then I have to believe it, even when it doesn't feel good to me. Tom Lamphere and I had spoken the evening I was fired. He reminded me of two important points. First, if I had any bitterness in my heart, it would only hurt me. While bitterness is a natural emotion, I knew I needed to pray and let God remove it so I could press on. Second, I needed to remember that this was all ultimately designed for good. Tom reminded me of Romans 8:28 and the Old Testament story of Joseph, which both have the same message. God is in control of our future, and He's working for our good, whether we can see it now or not. After talking with Tom, I was able to go out and sincerely thank the Glazers publicly for giving me the opportunity to coach their team. That attitude didn't come from me, but from the Lord, and I think it had an impact on a lot of people. Over the next couple of days, Lauren and I spent some time with our feet up and a lot of time on our knees. I didn't know why we were leaving the Bucks, but I knew God was closing this door for a reason. First, we needed to determine if we even wanted to remain in coaching. I wasn't convinced that we should. I believe we had done things God's way, or tried to, and He was moving us in another direction. My time with the Buccaneers had given me a tremendous following in the community and an ability to rally interest and enthusiasm around things that were important to me. I had been visiting prisons with Abe Brown since 1997. Abe, a longtime coach at Blake High School in Tampa, had founded a prison ministry in 1976 after visiting one of his former players behind bars. I loved walking around Tampa with Abe. The man knows everyone in town and probably has coached half of them. He's the only person I could walk with in Tampa and have more people know him than me. Even when I was coaching the Bucks, I knew if we were together and someone yelled, "Hey, coach," they were usually talking to Abe. Abe is an unassuming, low-key guy, and yet he's made a tremendous impact on the lives of many people in Tampa, including me. He started by visiting his former player, and when he learned the man had few, if any, other visitors, Abe kept going back, in part because he felt he had failed him as a coach. As Abe kept returning, he met other guys, talked with them, and tried to help them. Over time, these visits naturally developed into a prison ministry. In 1997, I was looking for ways to use my platform in Tampa, and Abe invited me to visit a prison with him. I was intrigued by that because I had grown up in a prison town. I knew people who had worked at the prison in Jackson, and today my sister works there. Although I really wanted to join Abe at the prison, I was a little afraid of going in. When the day arrived for our visit to Polk Correctional Institution, I was very nervous. I still carried images from my childhood of the hardened men I had always imagined who lived within the walls of the prison in Jackson. Even though I was 42 years old, no longer a child, I still pictured prisoners as old, belligerent, and calloused. I was coming with the message that there's always hope based on the gospel of Jesus Christ, but I had no idea how that message, or I, would be received. When Abe introduced me to some of the prisoners, I was shocked. Many of these old men looked like my sons, Jamie and Eric, perhaps 16, 17, 18 years old, and many of those who were in their 30s had actually come in as teenagers. This wasn't what I had expected at all. Most of the men were into football, and I found I had a common bond with them. They read the sports pages and the Bible. They loved talking about the Buccaneers, but they also wanted to talk about their dreams and what they might still accomplish when they were released. They were clinging to hope and seeking encouragement. A lot of those guys still stay in touch with me today, and for years I've been the beneficiary of all types of talent coming out of those prisons. I've received sketches, paintings, poetry, any means by which the inmates could express themselves. Many of them are very talented, and Abe is always looking for ways to create the right niche for them when they get out. As coach of the Bucks, I had only been able to make summer trips to the prisons, but now I was suddenly out of a job. I wondered whether God might be calling me to assist Abe in this ministry. After all, the inmate population had grown significantly since 1976, when Abe made his first visit. When he started, he could visit every prison in the state in about 3 days. Now that was impossible. Maybe this was what God was opening up in front of me. Or maybe it was All Pro Dad, which I had founded with Clyde Christensen and with Mark Merrill, a Tampa attorney, who had started an organization called Family First. Our original goal was to try to reach dads everywhere, whether in the city or the suburbs, married or single. Our message was simple. Dads, including us, need to spend more time with their kids. In 4 short years, All Pro Dad had grown into a national organization that sponsored clinics called All Pro Dad Father and Kids Experiences in NFL cities across the country and sent daily tips via email to fathers around the nation. All Pro Dad chapters have grown from an idea in Tampa to a reality in schools everywhere around the country, from Los Angeles to the Bronx. They continue to grow today, and Truett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A, has even requested that every Chick-fil-A franchise in the country host an All-Pro Dad monthly father's breakfast. Lauren and I were still seeking direction by the middle of that week. On one of those days, Lauren came home from running an errand, saw the blinking light on the answering machine, listened to the message, and saved it. When I walked in later, she directed me to listen to the message. It was from Jim Irsay, the owner of the Indianapolis Colts. He had just fired Jim Mora, and the message seemed to be expressing his interest in having me coach the Colts. It was difficult to know for sure, though, because this was not just a voice memo. It was a mission statement. Mr. Irsay started by saying that he did want me to be the head coach and then outlined where the Colts were at that time. Having only moved to Indianapolis in 1984, we don't have the long-established fan bases of Pittsburgh, Chicago, Cleveland, or other cities, he said, but we're still trying to develop that base. I want an organization and a team that emphasizes character, values, and family, and I want it to extend out into the community in a meaningful way. He went on to say that when he was a kid, he had been a ball boy for his dad and had watched the Steelers during the years I was playing. He said he aspired to be like the Rooneys and create that type of organization. You're the only person I want for this job, he said. He concluded his 15-minute mission statement by saying, don't worry about your salary and don't let your agent mess this up. I'll pay you whatever you want. We just need to talk man to man. Lauren looked at me, trying to read my face. Maybe God wasn't closing the football door after all. Jim Irsay and I spoke by phone later that day for an hour, and none of it was about football. We talked about the Colts family, about values, about community. He said he wanted to win, but he wanted to win the right way. And if we ever did win the Super Bowl, he wanted Indiana to feel a personal connection, for it to be their team and their trophy. I'm not sure I would have been interested in coaching at all if Jim hadn't left me that message with his ideas about my role as the new head coach of the Colts. It was exactly in line with the way I wanted to coach. In the next few days, the Carolina Panthers also contacted me. As I opened myself to that possibility, Carolina seemed like it could be a good fit as well. Both Indiana and North Carolina were good options. My warm-weather wife was probably pulling for Charlotte, but in the end, we both felt the Indianapolis Colts were a better fit for us. Jim Irsay's phone message had touched both of us. We decided that God was continuing the football dream for the Dungies, and not just the game, but also the ongoing platform and ministry opportunities. Hoping that we were still faithfully following God's leading, we joined the Colts. Coming to the Colts in 2002 was significantly different than arriving in Tampa in 1996. For one thing, Jim Irsay flew Lauren and me to Indianapolis on his private jet, and then we were taken in a helicopter from the airport to the Colts facility. Even from the air, I could tell that this was no one buck. For starters, the entire weight room was housed inside. There would be no lifting sessions on a patio. Mr. Irsay introduced me to the press as the new head coach of the Indianapolis Colts. From the outset, he announced that we were looking to accomplish something special, on and off the field. The Glazers had always been terrific about supporting things in which I was involved, but in this case, it was as if I were supporting Jim. From a football standpoint, the most notable difference from Tampa was having the offensive pieces in place already. The Colts were only a year removed from going to the playoffs and had been successful before that, so we didn't need to completely rebuild the organization as we had in Tampa. Indianapolis had plenty of veterans on offense, along with coaches I knew and respected. Tom Moore, my coach from the University of Minnesota, was the offensive coordinator. He had quarterback Peyton Manning running the same no-huddle offense he had run with me in the mid-70s. I also knew running backs coach Gene Huey and offensive line coach Howard Mudd, and I liked what they were doing on offense. I knew I wanted to change the Colts' defensive system, however, and sell my overall vision for the team and how I hoped to accomplish success. More than anything, my challenge with the Colts was to sell them on the idea that teams win championships. We needed to come together as a complete team, offense, defense, and special teams. My key sale in seeking to bring about this paradigm shift was Peyton Manning, the focused, talented quarterback out of the University of Tennessee. I had met Peyton once before in 1997. He and I were in Philadelphia for the Maxwell Football Club Awards. He was the Collegiate Player of the Year, and I was the Professional Coach of the Year. We had shared a limo to the banquet. When I arrived in Indianapolis to coach the Colts, after the introductory press conference with Jim Irsay, Peyton came back to the facility to talk with me. I was certain that he had forgotten all about our previous meeting, but as we walked into my office together, he commented that we had met before, but that I probably didn't remember. "I actually do," I said. "Me too. We shared a limo ride together. I sat in the back with you and your wife, Lauren, and you said you wished that someday you could coach me, but that you figured I'd be a first or second pick, so that probably wouldn't happen." He then went on to recount the remainder of the evening, including details that I had forgotten. I was amazed, and I learned something important about Peyton. He remembers everything. He went on, "Coach, I'm glad you're here. I want to be coached. I want to win. I want you to treat me like any other player and teach me what I need to do, because I want us to win." At the same time, he was concerned because he perceived that I might want to be conservative and not score points. He had seen many Buccaneers games in which my team scored very few points. "I actually like points," I told him. "I mainly like having more points than the other team when the game ends. What I want to teach our offense is how to avoid turning over the ball and putting our defense in bad position. What I want to teach our defense is how to stop the other team so they get the ball back for you quickly. If we're going to win," I continued, "you're going to have to trust me. You're going to have to trust that as we add defensive talent, it's part of a strategy to build a complete team so that we can win. We're going to be one team with all three units supporting and strengthening each other." Peyton nodded, but I'm not certain he really believed it. He had played 4 years, and most of the time the offense needed to score a lot of points for the Colts to win. "I'm not saying when the defense gets better we'll win. We'll win when we start working together as a team and not as separate units. We have to complement each other. Your job is to get us ahead and then let the defense do its work." I promoted this philosophy to the Colts for about a year and a half before I felt that everyone, including Peyton, really believed in it. That first year was a struggle in some ways. We went 10-6, a decent record, even though not everyone fully bought into what we were selling. But I was confident we would get there in time. One of the first things I did when I arrived in Indianapolis was to call the chaplain, Ken Johnson. I had met Ken at a Fellowship of Christian Athletes camp several years earlier. I asked him to come by my office so we could talk about our schedule and how I wanted to work with him. When he came to see me, Ken told me that although he had been the Colts chaplain for 11 years, he had never once been inside the head coach's office. I explained that I believed it was important for our players and our coaches to be connected spiritually, so he better get used to coming by. Three moments stand out from that 2002 season for me. The first occurred on a Monday early in the season. The offensive staff was meeting just down the hall from my office. Our running backs coach, Gene Huey, who had been with the Colts through the tenures of several head coaches before I arrived, froze. "Did you guys hear that? What was that sound?" The group stopped talking and listened. There was no sound other than laughter. "That's it, the laughing. Who is that?" Clyde Christensen, who had come with me from Tampa, spoke up. "Those are Tony's boys, Jamie and Eric. My boys didn't have school that day and were visiting me at work. They were doing the same thing they had done often in Tampa, hanging out in my office playing video games and watching TV, and I loved it. I especially loved it when I realized that families had not exactly been welcome in the Colts building, at least during the last few years. When Clyde told me this story later, I made it a point to let everyone on the team and staff know that their families were always welcome in our area of the building. Be respectful of other people's spaces, I said, but don't view this building as off limits. The coaches who came with me from Tampa assured everyone that kids would now be a pretty common sight, both at practice and on the sidelines during the games. The second memorable moment was our win in the Vet over the Eagles in November. We had always struggled against the Eagles when I was in Tampa, not scoring touchdowns and getting knocked out of the playoffs. That day we scored 5 touchdowns against a great defense on our way to a 35-13 win. Peyton threw for 3 touchdowns and James Mungro ran for more than 100 yards. As it turned out, it was possible to score touchdowns against the Eagles. The third special moment didn't involve the Colts at all. Derek Brooks called me from Tampa to relate a story he thought I'd appreciate. The Buccaneers were preparing to play their first game under their new coach, John Gruden. After the pregame warm-ups, they were back in the locker room, and John addressed the team with his final points before kickoff. As the team got up to leave the locker room, a few guys hesitated. This would normally have been the time when the team prayed before heading out to the field. John obviously wouldn't have known that. Besides, he was now in charge of game day procedures. Suddenly, Warren Sapp ordered everyone to come back. "We're going to pray," he said. "We've been doing this for 6 years, so somebody's got to step up and pray." Derek thought that would mean a lot to me. He was right. We made it to the playoffs that year as a wild card and had to travel to New York to face Herm Edwards' team, the Jets. They had gone 9-7 during the regular season, and it was shaping up to be a relatively even game. As always, I believed that if we could take a close game into the fourth quarter, we could win, even away from home. I told the team I was not a betting man, but if I were, I would bet my house on us. The Jets beat us 41-0. Another good reason I'm not a betting man. Following our playoff loss, I headed back down to Tampa to rejoin Lauren. When I took the job as head coach of the Colts, Lauren and I had agreed it would not be the best time to move Tierra, who was finishing her junior year of high school. So for 2 years, we had 2 homes, Lauren and the kids in Tampa while the kids were in school, and me in Indy. The family would fly up for games and during breaks. Even though we reunited most weekends during the season, the separation and constant travel had become a grind. So as soon as my immediate postseason responsibilities were over, I went to Tampa to be with them. Lauren had loved Tampa from the moment we first arrived in 96, but now the Bucs' popularity was becoming a little bit of a problem for her. In fact, the weeks leading up to the Bucs' Super Bowl victory in 2003 were really the only time that living in Tampa was anything short of perfect for Lauren. Super Bowl frenzy was everywhere, in the paper, on the radio, on television, in everyone's conversation. The comment we kept hearing was, "Thank goodness John Gruden came along to finish the job for Tony Dungy." That was painful to hear. John and the players were gracious in their comments toward me, and I appreciated that. But those 3 weeks were still difficult. I was excited for the team, and of course the players were ecstatic. But it still hurt not being there with them. Sometimes character lessons are hard to swallow, but I know that God used that period to stretch our faith and to help us grow and learn to trust Him more fully. Now I knew how Moses, the Old Testament prophet, must have felt. He had led the Israelites for 40 years through the desert, but he wasn't allowed into the Promised Land. He got to see it, but only from a distance. That growing experience couldn't have been pleasant for him either. A Super Bowl win with the Bucs would have been wonderful. I could have used that platform in a tremendous way. But I think my getting fired had an even greater impact. It's easy to be gracious when you're getting carried off the field in celebration. It's more difficult when you're asked to pack up your desk and your passcode doesn't work anymore. I think people look more closely at our actions in the rough times, when the emotions are raw and our guard is down. That's when our true character shows and we find out if our faith is real. If I'm going to call myself a Christian, I have to honor Jesus in the disappointments, too. Chapter 16, A Birthday Blessing. Mike Vanderjagt, our kicker, contributed to a rocky beginning for our 2003 season. Shortly into the offseason, Mike gave a wide-ranging interview that Well, let's just say I wish he would have phrased some things differently. Coming off our 41-0 loss to the Jets, Mike appeared on a Canadian TV station. He mostly talked about how frustrated he was about our loss, but the comments that seemed to get the most notice were those aimed at Peyton Manning and me. Mike hinted that the leadership of our team was insufficient. He said the team needed somebody who was going to get in people's face and yell and scream, and that I was too mild-mannered and even-keeled for us to be successful. My first reaction was that he was just going to have to get used to it. This is the way I coach, and I believed then and believe now that this is the best way to win football games and lead people. I had grown up with this philosophy. My mom used to say that a good leader gets people to follow him because they want to, not because he makes them, a principle reinforced by Coach Knoll. He always told me that players want to be good and that the coach's job is to teach them and give them the tools they need to improve. I never have been the type to get in people's face, and I never will be. My second reaction to Mike's comments was to release him or trade him. What he had said was completely unacceptable. We were a team, and neither he nor anyone else could put himself above the group. I called Mike at his home in Toronto and told him I needed to see him as quickly as possible. I have never liked cut days during training camp. Those are the days when we have to reduce our roster from 80 players down to 65 and then finally to 53. Cut days are my least favorite days in coaching. No matter how long you've been a coach, I don't think you ever get used to it. Usually, the guys you have to release have done nothing wrong. On the contrary, they've done everything you've asked and have gone to the limits of their ability. But in the end, they're simply not as talented or they don't fit our schemes as well as someone else. I don't generally like to make individual cuts either, unless unusual circumstances force me to. But there are times when a player needs to be removed from our team, and that time was now. I was steamed. And after our loss to the Jets, no one else was in a good mood either. At our final team meeting, I had told the players that we had to stick together, that people were going to try to pick us apart and get us splintered in different directions. I didn't think it would happen from within, but that's exactly where it was now coming from. I was burning. Mike Vanderjagt was finished with the Colts, and the sooner he got to Indianapolis for me to cut him, the better. Mike still had to travel from Toronto to Indianapolis. Before he arrived, my son Jamie intervened. Jamie and Eric were often around the facility in those days, hanging out in my office or around the guys. While Eric usually kept to himself, Jamie was always looking to make new friends. He generally believed that anyone he met was a potential friend. If anyone even as much as smiled at Jamie, it was confirmation enough that he had added another friend to the ranks. Jamie seemed especially drawn to people who were down on their luck, like talkative kickers. Jamie'd been reading the sports pages, and he came into my office to ask me about the situation. "Why is everybody mad at Mike, Dad?" "Because of what he said." "Dad, you can't get rid of Mike. He's my friend." "Well, I can promise you this, Jamie," I said, trying to reassure my concerned 16-year-old. "I won't do anything just because of what other people are saying or because of what's in the paper. I plan to bring him in here and talk to him. If I do decide to get rid of him, it will only be because the team needs it." Jamie seemed pacified, at least for the moment, but I knew he was still giving it a great deal of thought. Mike took 2 days to get to Indianapolis from Toronto. If he had arrived the night I first called him, I'm sure I would have cut him or asked Bill Polian, our president, to trade him. The following day, I still felt the same way. But on the third day, I was reading our daily Bible passage. A number of us, both coaches and players, were still reading through the Bible each year. It was Matthew 21:28-32, a parable Jesus told about a father and two sons. The father told the two sons to go to work in the vineyard. The first son said he would not go, but later changed his mind and went out. The second son said he would go, but then didn't. Jesus' point is that the first son was obedient in spite of his words. It's what is in our hearts that matters, even if our words say otherwise. I immediately realized that my situation was very similar to this parable. I had heard Mike's words in the press and rushed to judgment without hearing his side of the story. When Mike finally came in, he didn't deny making those statements, and he did apologize. He said he had been frustrated, and he explained that the media had not reported what he had been trying to say. Things had not come out the way he had wanted them to. We talked through his comments at length. I told him that he had done damage to our team that would be difficult to undo, and I'd have to think that through. Then I asked him the most important question. Do you still want to kick for the Colts? He immediately said that he did, more than anything in the world. He had no desire to go anywhere else. He believed we could be successful, and he wanted to be a part of that journey. It's amazing how many times my assigned daily scripture reading has been something I needed to read, fitting exactly where I was and what I was going through at the time. That day, I decided that leading as Jesus would lead meant looking into Mike's heart. After talking with Mike, I went against the advice I was getting from most of the football experts and decided to keep him on our team. Despite the Vanderjagt incident, we started the 2003 regular season hot. At the end of September, we were 4-0 and looking for our fifth straight win. We were playing well on both sides of the ball, and Mike Vanderjagt was kicking well. Our fifth game was a matchup straight out of a Hollywood script. On October 6th, on Monday Night Football, and my 48th birthday, we would play the defending Super Bowl champions and my old team, the Buccaneers. In Tampa, no less. I tried to keep things as normal as possible that week. I remembered all too well a situation we had faced while I was at Tampa, after we had traded with the Jets for Keyshawn Johnson. When we played the Jets the following year, Rich McKay and I let Key have a separate press conference before the normal media session. We figured that way he could address all the New York questions at once, then the distractions would die down and we could get back to normal. Unfortunately, it had the opposite effect. With all the attention focused on him, Key made some comments that really stirred things up in New York. I think it also gave our team the impression that there was something different about that game. Now, having learned that lesson, I was determined to keep the preparation for the Colts-Bucks game the same as it had been every other week. I prayed all week that it would be a smooth return to Tampa and that I wouldn't get too emotional, high or low. The week went fairly smoothly, but Monday night did turn out to be an incredibly emotional evening for me. Pre-game was such a special experience as I visited with the Buccaneers coaches, players, and staff on the field. I was experiencing so many emotions and so many good memories. I'm afraid I wasn't of much use to the Colts during pre-game, as I spent most of my time trying not to cry. We headed off the field and returned to the visitors' locker room to await kickoff. Before that day, I had never been in that locker room, and I had never come onto the field through the visitors' tunnel. I was a little anxious about the pregame introductions. In the NFL, each team introduces either its starting offense or defense, followed by the head coach. I usually don't pay too much attention to that introduction. That's my time to look at the corners of the stadium. But this time, I wasn't sure how I would react. Jamie and Eric were with me on the field, and Lauren and Tierra were in the stands with friends. I wondered how the crowd would respond to me. I didn't know what they thought of me anymore. As we got closer to kickoff, I realized that the crowd's reaction mattered a great deal to me. I knew I'd get some boos. After all, I was now on the opposing sideline. But Tampa had been our home for 6 years, and the people of that community were an important part of our lives. I hoped that, in spite of my having left the Bucks, the people of our old community would be welcoming. I just didn't know what to expect. I was caught completely by surprise when the crowd erupted with applause as soon as my name was called. I was overwhelmed. The tears I had fought back earlier could no longer be quelled. I didn't know it then, but this would not be the last time the fans of Tampa would rally around me. The ovation was a very moving moment, but it was long gone by the time we returned to the locker room at halftime, trailing 21-0. We hadn't played our game at all. The Buccaneers' top-ranked defense had given up only 86 yards to us in the first half, while our sixth-ranked defense had been torched for 239 yards. I was extremely disappointed. Here we had a chance to show the country what we were all about, and so far we had responded by self-destructing. We had nobody to blame but ourselves. We couldn't have played any worse than we did the first 30 minutes of that game. Even though I had preached all week to our guys, we couldn't afford to fall behind against Tampa Bay. I had explained over and over that if the Bucs' defense knew we had to throw, their pass rush would just tee off. Their defense was too strong if we were playing from behind. At halftime, I explained that we needed to do what we do with passion and execution and see what happened. The guys responded. Initially, we came out and scored on our opening drive to make it 21-7. but the Bucks then drove the length of the field for a touchdown, and the third quarter ended with us still down by 21. We scored another touchdown to start the fourth quarter, but then, with just over 5 minutes left in the game, Bucks cornerback Rondé Barber picked off a pass from Peyton and ran it back for a Tampa Bay touchdown and a 35-14 lead. I had been in this position many times with the Buccaneers defense, and it was never pretty for the opposing offense. I turned to Tom Moore before the kickoff. Our offense was set to go back on the field, but I felt there was no point in getting anyone hurt now. Playing on Monday night meant we had a short week to prepare for our next game. I thought we ought to take the first group off the field, especially since the Bucs' defensive line would be coming full bore with a big lead. Let's get Peyton and the other starters out of there. Tony, let's just go one more drive and see what happens, Tom counseled. Brad Pyatt ran the kickoff back 87 yards to Tampa's 12-yard line, and we sent the first team offense back out there. Four plays later, we scored, 35-21. We tried an onside kick and recovered the ball. We scored again, stopped them, and scored a third time to tie the game and send it into overtime. We had scored three touchdowns in the last 3 minutes and 43 seconds of the game. We won in overtime 38-35 when Mike Vanderjagt kicked the field goal. As I walked back to the locker room, it dawned on me. The Lord had allowed us to win, but only in a way in which He had to get the credit. No NFL team had ever come back from three touchdowns behind in the final 4 minutes, but we did it while playing poorly, on the road, on Monday Night Football, against the Super Bowl champions with the top defense in the NFL, in Tampa, on my birthday. It was nothing short of miraculous. Such a thing is almost impossible to imagine, but nothing is impossible for God to accomplish. Back in the locker room, Lauren had a cake waiting, and the guys sang happy birthday to me. John Lynch, Tampa's all-pro strong safety, waited for me to come out of the locker room so he could give me a hug, even though by that time it was approaching 2 a.m. That game gave us all a new perspective on faith and the way God works in the circumstances of our lives. It also reinforced what we already knew, that if we do what we do without panicking, we can accomplish great things. We would draw on that lesson in the future. A few weeks later, we again traveled to Florida for a division game against the Jaguars. We were preparing for kickoff under the gray skies with a light, cool breeze blowing off the St. John's River across the stadium. Suddenly, I was tapped on the shoulder by a security guard. "Coach, I'm sorry, but your son can't be on the sideline." I was startled, and it took me a moment to realize he was talking about Eric, who was 11 at the time and had been at my side for various games, when it wasn't Jamie's turn, for the last 4 seasons. "No," I said, "he's going to stay with me for the game." The guard was firm. "Sorry, coach, but he can't be on the sideline. League rules." I was just as firm. As our debate continued, I heard through my headset that the guys were about to take the field. "He's been doing this since he was 7. He'll be right here with me. Sorry, he's going to have to go." This had gone on long enough. "He's staying here with me, and if you remove him from this sideline, I'm taking my team to the locker room, where we'll change and then leave on our buses. You can explain to Wayne," a reference to the Jaguars owner, Wayne Weaver, "why he's refunding everyone's money." The guard blinked, and I finished my thought. "You might want to double check with your head coach before you do that, however." That was the last I heard of the issue, and no one has brought it up since. Of course, Eric is now as tall as I am, and I'm wondering when Jordan will be ready for a trip to Jacksonville. We opened the 2003 playoffs at home against Denver, who had beaten us just 2 weeks earlier. They had run against us at will in a game that we needed for a first-round bye. Instead, we lost 31-17. Now that we're in the playoffs, the media asked what we were going to do differently. "Nothing," I told them. "We're going to do what we always do, only do it better." And we did. We drilled the Broncos 41-10 in a game which everything went right. We then traveled to play the number 2 seed, Kansas City. It was a terrific time for me, returning to Kansas City and the good memories of coaching with the Chiefs. They hadn't lost any home games during the regular season, and they had one of the loudest stadiums in the NFL. We stayed hot on offense, though, winning the game 38-31. In 2 playoff games, we had scored 10 touchdowns without a single punt. Now we were headed to New England. They had earned home field advantage by beating us in Indianapolis in November, a game in which we had come from 21 points down to tie, but ultimately lose. The AFC Championship and a trip to the Super Bowl were on the line. The game started slowly for us. We had trouble moving the ball and turned it over a couple of times. The Patriots controlled the tempo and kept the ball away from us with a good offensive game plan. They took the lead and held it throughout the game. As bad as it was, though, we got the ball back in the last few minutes down 21-14. We needed one good drive to tie the game. All year we had converted in these situations, and I was confident we could do it this time. But once again, the New England defense stopped us when it counted. An insurance field goal by Adam Vinatieri made the final score 24-14. The New England Patriots rarely made mistakes, and they knew how to capitalize on the mistakes of their opponents. They were the epitome of what Coach Knoll had always talked about. They did the ordinary things better than everyone else. And because of that, I knew we would continue to have our problems with them, just as everyone else did. At some point during the 2003 season, Jim Irsay began having my dad fly with us to our away games. That was typical of the little things Jim does for all his employees, not just the head coach. So my dad was at the New England game, as he had been for just about every one of my games since I was 12 years old. For the sixth time, he saw my season end with a playoff loss. He was disappointed that we hadn't played well enough to win, but he never changed his expression or demeanor. He told me not to get discouraged and that he knew we'd get to the Super Bowl if we continued to persevere. Chapter 17, Death by Inches. I was excited and believed that everything was moving in the right direction for the Colts. When the 2004 season rolled around, we felt as if we were on the cusp of taking that final step and making it to the Super Bowl. In the second round of the 2004 draft, we added another key piece to the puzzle with Bob Sanders, a safety from the University of Iowa. Right after the draft, however, that good feeling was temporarily interrupted when I received a phone call from my dad. He told me that although he felt great, a routine physical had revealed a problem with his blood work. Another test confirmed the doctor's suspicions, leukemia. I was in shock because my dad was in such great shape for his age. Every day he woke up at 5:30, rode his bike about 5 miles to Bob Evans for breakfast, and then rode back home. 2 days a week he went to the YMCA to swim. I could hardly believe this vigorous man had a serious health problem. My sister Lauren, the doctor, brought my dad to Indianapolis for treatment at the world-class oncology center at the Indiana University School of Medicine. He went through an extensive chemotherapy regimen over the next couple of months. I loved that time with him. He didn't seem to be experiencing any of the side effects the doctors had warned us about. Just sitting in his hospital room was wonderful. We reminisced about fishing and hooks through the ear and Tiger games and Michigan State games. I reminded him of times when we had visited my aunt and uncle, staying up late to watch war movies and westerns with them. Even though my dad had thought I should be in bed, my uncle Paul had always talked him into letting me stay up. My dad remembered playing catch and shooting baskets with me, all the quality moments that a father spends with his son. During my days with my dad, I thought a lot about the time I had spent with my own children. When I was growing up, my dad spent quality and quantity time with us. He always made sure he was around the house and at our games. I hadn't always done that with my children. I tried to shorten my work days to give the players Sundays off whenever possible and make sure everyone got home at a reasonable hour, but the time I spent with my children was nowhere near the amount of time my dad had made for us. This was probably the first time I ever thought about purposely leaving coaching on my own accord. I had already made adjustments years ago, starting meetings later so I could take my children to school, never sleeping at the office, allowing families to be together in our offices, and short of leaving the profession, I didn't think there were any other changes I could make. I began to give the idea some serious thought. Football is a vocation and an opportunity for ministry, but it's not a life. It helped a little knowing that Lauren and the kids would be moving to Indianapolis full-time that summer, even though we would still keep the house in Tampa. Tierra had finished high school, and after missing 2 years of driving my kids to school, I was eager to see them again on a daily basis. In June, we got some great news from my dad's doctors. The leukemia was in remission, and my dad was going to be able to go home to my sister's house. We were relieved and thrilled. My dad was excited because he wanted to be around when we made it to the Super Bowl. He had always claimed that a Super Bowl appearance was inevitable for us if we stayed the course and did what we did. Less than a week later, the tide turned again when my sister called and said that we needed to come to the hospital immediately to visit my dad before he died. With his white blood cell count extremely low from the chemotherapy, his immune system had been vulnerable, and he had developed an infection. He died that night, June 8th, only 29 months after my mom had passed. In the space of 2 months, we went from the fears of a leukemia diagnosis and the rigors of the treatment to the euphoria of his recovery, to loss and grief. A lot of our family members came into town the next day, and I needed to attend to the last day of our off-season workouts. Actually, I didn't really need to be there. The assistants could have handled it. It was only a couple of hours, but then I thought about my dad and the things he had always taught me. More than anything else, my dad loved watching practice. I knew he would have wanted me to be with my team. I arrived at the facility. Jeff Saturday, a great player and even better person, was one of the few players who knew my dad had died. After practice, Jeff let the team know about my dad's death before I explained why I was there with them that day. My dad always felt like practice was where you did your job. If a student learned during the week and studied hard, the test would be easy and take care of itself. It's the same way with practice. He liked you guys and especially liked the way you practice. That's why he always felt confident we were going to do well. Most of the veterans knew my dad because he had been around so much. But that day, our rookies learned a little bit about why I am the way I am. Under a clear blue sky, a man sprints to catch a speeding train. He has fired a machine gun at his pursuers, Nazis, and thrown grenades at them, setting various other charges and traps for them as well. Now he is almost caught up with the German transport train that he and his fellow prisoners of war have commandeered and are riding into Switzerland. He closes in on the train, running with his hand out, and is shot and killed with his hand just inches from his fellow prisoners and only feet away from the Swiss border in safety. Death by inches. I showed that movie clip in the first meeting of training camp in 2004. When the clip ended, I explained the theory of death by inches, which Frank Sinatra suffered at the end of Von Ryan's Express. It was one of those movies I had watched as a boy late at night with my Uncle Paul, my Aunt Rosemarie, and my dad. I explained to the team that it wasn't the big things that had tripped us up in the previous years, but rather a combination of small details. By focusing on those details, inches, we could reach our goal rather than coming up just short. We're not going to focus on improving last year's 12-4 season, but we are going to look to improve and win our first game. And then we'll get better and win our second game. We're going to do it by doing the little things right. As a head coach, I'm interviewed by the media a great deal, and I pride myself in answering questions honestly without becoming a distraction. As a result, I tend not to find myself in the midst of controversy. But in 2004, I did. More than once. The first incident occurred just after the Philadelphia Eagles played on Monday Night Football. At the time, ABC was opening those broadcasts with skits featuring star players. That week's skit showed an actress from Desperate Housewives standing alone in the locker room with Philadelphia Eagles receiver Terrell Owens, who is African American. Wearing only a towel, she provocatively asked Terrell to skip the game for her, and after several rebuffs, finally convinced him, dropping her towel and jumping into his arms. T.O. grinned and said something along the lines of, "The guys will understand." I didn't get home that night until after the game had started, so I didn't know anything about the skit until the next day. When I saw a tape of the opening, I couldn't believe it. I was disgusted. Later, I asked Eric, who was then 12, if he had seen the beginning of the game. He told me he had, so we talked about it for a while. Eric had been in our locker room before enough games to know that something like that could never happen, and he thought the skit was dumb. I wondered, however, what other young kids might be thinking after watching that skit. I also wondered what Eric was thinking but not telling me. During my next media session, I didn't wait for anyone to ask about the broadcast. I brought it up and said I thought it was totally inappropriate. I said I was displeased with the sexual nature of the skit and it's being shown on prime time just before a nationally televised, family-friendly football game. I said I thought it was a slam on NFL football players and I was upset with ABC for using an African-American player. Unfortunately, of the many things I objected to in the skit, the only thing people focused on was that last statement. I began to hear comments that I was a racist and opposed to interracial dating, which isn't true and entirely missed the point I had tried to make. I did believe ABC was either very insensitive or deliberately stereotypical in using an African-American player for that skit, but my comments had nothing to do with the actress. I knew for a fact the network had not approached Peyton Manning about being in the skit, and I was sure they would not have asked Brett Favre or Tom Brady either. I was disappointed in ABC for coming up with the idea, and I was disappointed in T.O. for going along with it. I was surprised that more players, especially those who were African-American, didn't see anything wrong with it. Terrell had created the perception, even if it was in jest, that he would be willing to miss a kickoff to have sex with a stranger. The whole thing sent the wrong message about morality, responsibility, and NFL players to kids like Eric. But all of that got lost just because I mentioned race. Some people did get what I was trying to say. Bill Belichick, head coach of the New England Patriots, was one of those people. He backed me, saying as I had that he'd be willing to take a pay cut if the NFL needed commercials like that to pay the bills. The second media stir occurred when I tried to bring a little balance and levity to an incident involving Randy Moss of the Minnesota Vikings. Thankfully, this was a much smaller deal. After a touchdown during a playoff game at Lambeau Field, Moss pretended to moon the fans. His actions were clearly inappropriate, and I didn't want to excuse them, but at the same time, I was somewhat amused because I knew what was behind Randy's act. When asked about it, I said if there were ever a place we could count on for a mooning, it was Lambeau Field. I had played there every season from 1992 to 2001, sometimes more than once, and I had learned that it was a tradition there for a few Packer fans to drop their pants around their ankles and moon the visiting team's bus as it left, regardless of the temperature. When Moss scored the winning touchdown, I knew what he was doing. He was beating those Packer fans to the punch. I got plenty of mail from people who thought I showed a double standard in defending Moss after being so outspoken about protecting the image of our players in the ABC incident, and they were right. In retrospect, I should have been much more clear in stating that I was explaining, not condoning, what Randy Moss had done. Those two incidents made me even more aware of the need to think through the ramifications of everything I say as a head coach. I'm still learning. That was off the field. On the field, we had another fun year. We went 12-4 and won the AFC South Division for the second straight year. Our defense continued to improve, but our offense, especially our passing game, reached a level never seen before. Marvin Harrison had been playing at a Hall of Fame level as our right wide receiver for several years. Reggie Wayne, our first-round draft choice in 2001, was now growing comfortable in his role on the left side. And the year before, we had acquired Brandon Stokley to play in the slot. In 2004, those three players became the first set of teammates in NFL history to each reach 1,000 yards receiving and 10 touchdown catches in the same year. Peyton Manning set an NFL record with 49 touchdown passes. That was a great accomplishment, and I was especially pleased that he had set this record while throwing only 10 interceptions. Our prophetic conversation in 2002 was coming true, and the transformation of our offensive mindset was clear. Peyton had thrown 23 interceptions the year before I arrived, and 19 our first year together. In 2003 and 2004, he had thrown only 10 each year, and his touchdown passes were now coming in record numbers. We were finally playing explosive football without committing turnovers. My biggest learning experience that year, however, was from a game we lost. We played Kansas City on Halloween. We had beaten them in the playoffs the year before in a shootout, but this year they lit us up, 45-35. We had just lost two games in a row, something that hadn't happened for a long time. I sensed that the guys were concerned, especially about the defense. I was very direct at Monday's team meeting. Men, we're not going to bring in any new players. We're not going to add any new defensive schemes. In fact, we're not going to change anything. We're the same group that went to the playoffs last year. We just have to do our jobs a little bit better, a little bit faster, a little bit sharper. I really didn't think anything of it at the time. That's just what I thought we needed to do. But Gary Brackett, one of our linebackers, said later that because of that reassurance, the players were able to relax and concentrate on improving rather than worry about whether they still had a job. I would use that talk again during a crucial time down the road. Bill Belichick, New England's head coach, had supported me over the ABC flap, but of course he wasn't much support to me on the field. We still didn't break through and beat the Patriots. As sharp as we had played most of the year, we just couldn't seem to duplicate that sharpness against New England. We lost the season opener to them in Foxborough, Massachusetts, 27-24. We played well the rest of the year, but we just couldn't make up that ground on the Patriots. So in January, in the playoffs, we found ourselves back in Foxborough, and the game followed the same maddening script. We fell behind early, allowed them to control the football, and lost 20-3. New England had a great football team, and they would go on to win another Super Bowl that year. Through these painful defeats, we never had the feeling we couldn't beat them. We simply had to play as well against them as we played against other teams. Easier said than done. Once again, I closed out the 2004 season in the visitors' locker room in Foxborough, telling our players that we would regroup, work hard, and do what we do in 2005. I hoped that they wouldn't lose faith, because I was certain 2005 would be an unforgettable year. Chapter 18, An Unforgettable Season. After starting the season 5-0, Leslie Frazier, one of my assistant coaches, bought me a blank journal. He had been urging me to write a book, and he was convinced that 2005 was going to be a special season. In October, it sure looked that way. Bill Polian, our president, has a great eye for talent, and he had put together a tremendous team. Our high draft choices were all coming through for us, and some of our lower round draft choices, such as linebacker Cato June and defensive end Robert Mathis, were starting to play like Pro Bowlers. Our only real question mark was in the middle of our defensive line. Just before the regular season began, Bill had signed Corey Simon, a former Pro Bowl tackle who had been locked in a contract dispute with the Philadelphia Eagles. Around the league, Corey's signing was viewed as the coup that just might vault us into the Super Bowl. The way we played that first month, it was hard to argue with that. I still didn't think I would ever write a book, but I figured it might be worth keeping a journal of the season anyway. According to my journal, we were studying Acts 15 in our coach's Bible study at the time, and we'd been reading about Paul, who on more than one occasion suffered in a cold, damp jail cell. Patience in waiting out God's plan, I wrote. Do what you're supposed to do while waiting. I wondered if I could do it. I knew I couldn't if I had to do it alone. That week, we beat the Rams on Monday Night Football, coming back from a 17-point deficit to win by 17. Quite a swing. 3 weeks later, we played the Patriots in Foxborough again. We were undefeated, and New England was not playing that well, but even so, the media made a big deal of the game. I kept preaching to our guys that we shouldn't think about it being New England. We just needed to focus on the Colts. We needed to think about what it took for us to play well and not worry about anything else. Going into the game, I really believed we would finally play well up there. It was a night game, so I had some extra time during the day. I took my customary late morning walk through Providence and the campus of Brown University. It was such a pretty fall day, I wished we were playing at 1 p.m. As I walked, I had a calm feeling inside. I was sure we were going to execute well. We did just that. Peyton Manning and our receivers had a big game, as did running back Edgerrin James. We won 40-21. Walking back to the locker room, I started to get concerned about how the media would react to this win. After beating the defending champions in their stadium, I was sure they would be ready to anoint us the new kings. Since we were just at the halfway point of the season, I wanted to make sure we didn't fall into that trap. I went in to talk to the guys, and as I had so many times before, I used a Bible verse to make my point. Pride goes before destruction, I told them. We won big today, but let's not forget how we did it. We worked hard. This was only one game, and now it's over. We need to continue to do what we do. After beating Houston, we played on the Sunday before Thanksgiving against Cincinnati. I was pleased to see that Marvin Lewis was turning the losing mindset around in the city of Cincinnati, much as we had turned it around in Tampa years earlier. During my pregame walk, I couldn't help but notice all the signs showing the city's support of the Bengals. Some local fans who recognized me assured me how much trouble the Colts would be in for later that day. It was quite a change from previous trips we'd made to Cincinnati. The atmosphere within the stadium was great, and we were pleased to escape with a 45-37 win. I continued to journal, noting a memorable Thanksgiving holiday. Because our next game would be against Pittsburgh on Monday night, I was able to give our coaches and players all day Thursday off, which is rare. Normally, we squeeze practices in on holidays, one of the downsides of our work. With an extra day to prepare, we were able to forget about football for once and just enjoy the holiday. Ricky Thomas, our tight ends coach, and Jim Caldwell, our assistant head coach and quarterback coach, brought their families to our house for the Thanksgiving celebration. Tierra flew home from Atlanta, where she was a student at Spelman College, and Jamie, who was attending Hillsborough Community College in Tampa, came for the gathering too. Lauren had begun a practice years ago that has since become a tradition for us, asking us all to select a meaningful scripture verse and share something that we're thankful for. Even though we were having a great year on the field, we were 10-0 at that point, not one person mentioned football. My verse was Philippians 1:3. Every time I think of you, I give thanks to my God. I told everyone how thankful I was to have so many friends and family members to share the day with. God had really blessed us with so many special people. I really enjoyed that Thanksgiving, and our house was filled with family and friends. In fact, we had so much fun that we lost track of time. Before we knew it, Tierra and Jamie were rushing out the door so that Jamie could catch his flight back to Tampa. They said a quick goodbye to everyone and hurried out to the car without even time for a hug. I waved goodbye and got back to my guests, never giving it a second thought, other than hoping Tierra wouldn't get a speeding ticket on the way to the airport. I knew I'd see Jamie again at Christmas, and I'd get my hug then. We beat Pittsburgh that Monday night, and the RCA Dome was as electric as I had ever experienced. Marvin Harrison caught an 80-yard touchdown pass on our first play of the game, and from there the noise never stopped. It was so loud that some of the Pittsburgh writers accused us of piping in extra noise. We kept the enthusiasm going into December, beating the Jacksonville Jaguars to go to 13-0. My journal entry of December 11th notes how excited we were on the flight home after winning in Jacksonville. We had kept our composure in a physical, hard-fought game. Toward the end, we pulled away to clinch a first-round bye and home field advantage for the whole playoffs. The bye had been our primary goal, but we were also thrilled that we would be playing in front of our fans throughout the playoffs. That was the last time I journaled in 2005. As a head coach, I occasionally received middle-of-the-night phone calls, usually about some trouble one of our players had gotten into. At 1:45 in the morning, Thursday, December 22nd, the phone rang, and Lauren handed it to me. "I hope one of our guys isn't hurt," I thought as I reached for the receiver. This time the call was not about a player. It was about our son. For reasons that will never be fully known, Jamie had taken his own life. As the nurse was speaking to me, I frantically began to pray for Jamie, but as her words sank in, it became increasingly clear that we were beyond that point. Jamie was gone. The next several days were all a fog. Lauren and I flew to Tampa on Jim Irsay's plane to make funeral arrangements and then flew back to Indianapolis for Christmas. Vikings chaplain Tom Lamphere called me while we were selecting Jamie's gravesite. "Tony, sit tight. I'm going to find a flight. I'll be in Indy tonight." "Tom, just come down to Tampa for the funeral," I told him. "You can't be away from your family on Christmas." I tried to make him take no for an answer, but I knew he wouldn't. He's just one of those special people who would do anything for a friend. Over the next several days, our family would be surrounded by a lot of those people. Tom sat quietly with us during Christmas. We attended the regular worship service at our church on Sunday, Christmas morning. Our congregation was unbelievable. People never quite know what to say at times like this. There really is nothing you can say, but we could feel everyone's love, and it was uplifting. Lauren and I weren't sure how we'd get through this, but we recognized that we were going to have to cling to God's strength and love if we were going to have a chance. It wasn't until days later, when I was standing over Jamie's casket and preparing for the visitation, that it really started to sink in and become real. I'm never going to see him again. At some point on Christmas Day, Tom had told us, "Life will never be the same again, but you won't always feel like you do right now." I clung to that statement as I looked down at my young son's face in that casket, just 2 weeks short of his 19th birthday. So sweet, so compassionate, so handsome, so gentle, so sensitive, so kind to kids who got picked on, so much like Lauren, so many people who loved him. The next couple of days would bear out how loved Jamie was. Thousands of people attended his visitation in Tampa. It was a cold night, I'm told. I don't remember. People stood outside for hours in that cold. There were people we knew from the area and others who had traveled great distances, people from every team we'd ever worked for, mixing with people we had never met before then. High school and college classmates of Jamie, or James as he had begun to introduce himself, attended in great numbers. Folks from our church, Bucks fans, people who had watched us through the years, those who just wanted to hug me or Lauren, people who couldn't stand football, people who understood when I said that it was only football. The city of Tampa, our home, stood up for us once again, this time with a different kind of ovation. We were determined to make Jamie's funeral a celebration of his life, a homegoing, we called it. Jamie had accepted Christ as a small child and had stayed close to him through the years. Because of that, we knew his salvation was unchanged regardless of the demons he may have faced. We took comfort in knowing that his soul was in heaven, even as we made our preparations to donate his organs and bury his body. The service was a blessing for us, and from the comments I heard afterward, I believe it was a blessing for others as well. I spoke for about 20 minutes at the conclusion of the service, not knowing if I would be able to get through it. With the Lord's strength and wisdom, I talked about Jamie's life on earth, and more important, his eternal life through Jesus. "It's great to be here today," I began. Then I paused, knowing that people felt I must have misspoken. "I know that's a strange-sounding message, but when you came in today, one of the first songs you heard was, 'I will bless the Lord at all times,' which says, 'I will bless the Lord, and praise for him will always be in my mouth.' I explained that those words were taken from Psalm 34, which David wrote. David didn't write that at a time of triumph. He wrote it when he was on the run from Saul, fleeing for his life in desperation. Even so, he was able to say that he would constantly praise God and bless him. That's not easy to do. In fact, it's difficult at times. The only way we can praise God at all times is to remember that God can provide joy in the midst of a sad occasion. Our challenge today is to find that joy." I was thinking these last few days about a number of things, primarily how I would like for you to remember Jamie, I said. Those thoughts brought joy as well. As you've heard many people describe him already today, Jamie was compassionate and friendly. I nodded towards the Colts organization, all of whom had flown down for Jamie's homegoing celebration. So many of these guys sitting here were nice to Jamie. Players and coaches and others, you were great to him, and we thank you. We are grateful to you. I also want to offer a special thanks to Mr. Glazer. I looked over and saw Mr. Glazer seated with his family.